This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today I am pleased to welcome Nathan Holmes, who is the author of Fear City, Crime Film, Crisis, and the Urban Imagination from SUNY Press. Nathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
My pleasure. So if you would, let's start off. Just tell us a little bit about who you are and how it is that you came to this particular project.
Sure. So currently I'm a visiting professor of cinema studies at SUNY Purchase College in New York. And previously I've taught film and media classes at Loyola University in Chicago, University of Iowa, and the University of Chicago, and a few other places. I have a PhD in cinema and media studies from the University of Chicago. And the research that I do is mostly concerned with the relationship between film history and urban history, and as well as the built environment and its relationship to cinema and media. And I'm also interested in the history of film theory. My primary interest is the way that film and visual media allow us to kind of see and understand our physical surroundings in new ways. So in graduate school, I became very interested in the connection of film to theories of urban experience and urban modernity, particularly in the writings of people like Walter Benjamin and Jörg Zimmel, Siegfried Krakauer. And I was also interested in the way that moving images in early cinema played a role in both kind of documenting urban life from, you know, the Lumiere brothers and the scenes of Lyon that they offered in their early films to Thomas Edison, and in the way that film aesthetics itself kind of replicated the sensory experience of big city life. So the disorienting sense that one got in being in crowds, and the fleeting encounters one would have in the city, this kind of disorienting sense of space and time, the way that that was replicated in certain types of camera effects and things like montage, which was a style of seeing that, film introduced. So being on the street was kind of an overwhelming experience. And then film itself was kind of doubling this experience for audiences in movie theaters. And I myself was from a very small town and had recently moved to go to graduate school to big cities, first Toronto and then Chicago. And so a lot of these ideas really resonated and appealed to me. So I also became interested in the different types of narrative forms and genres related to the kind of explosion of big cities that happens in the 19th century. So I was really interested in melodrama and the detective novel, and especially, the writings of people like Edgar Allan Poe, who use the detective story as a way to kind of explore the modern urban world of strangers and urban circulation. And my interest here was in the way that these narratives and the detective stories, the way that they converted urban experience into kind of an aesthetic that would both kind of resolve the problems of urban life, that would kind of address and engage the stresses associated with living in the city, and also kind of replay them. So in a kind of more therapeutic atmosphere, you know, you would read a detective story at night after you'd been experiencing the big city all day. So I was kind of fascinated by that. And at the same time that I was reading all this stuff and becoming interested in all this stuff, I was also watching a lot of films from the 1970s, a lot of crime films. And I was starting to see connections between all these ideas and the crime films, especially location shot crime films that were made in the United States during the 1970s.
So there you go. So that's the perfect segue. We are, by the way, this is the New Books Network Public Policy Channel. We're speaking with Nathan Holmes, author of Fear City, Crime Film Crisis, and the Urban Imagination. So I want to, if we can, Nathan, just sort of home in on three of the films that you focus on in the book, Clute, Serpico, and The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Sure.
As a way to maybe communicate to our listeners the kinds of insights that you think there are to be gleaned in making sense of this very sort of particular moment in urban America, right? Sort of the,
right.
The urban crisis of the 1970s, which I think still, I mean, I think sort of if you think about the current president and the way that he talks about cities, I think
right.
It still resonates in the American imagination in particular kinds of mm-hmm. ways. So let's, if we can, let's start with Clute. And if you would maybe just offer a brief synopsis for either folks who haven't seen the movie or folks like me who haven't seen it in quite some time.
Okay, sure.
And then if you would tell us why you think it matters, right? Why should we, what do we learn from Clute when we try to make sense of this particular period?
Sure, sure. So Clute is directed by Alan Pakula, and it's a detective story basically about a man, a suburban man who goes missing in New York. And a detective named Clute, played by Donald Sutherland, is sent to New York to search for him. And he is he contacts a woman played by Jane Fonda, Bree Daniels, who was a prostitute, a kind of very high-end escort, who has some knowledge or connection to this missing person. And together, what they do is search for this missing man, and they kind of move through different spaces in the city. And my interest in Clute primarily was in the director's sense for the architectural spaces of New York in the 1970s, and particularly his interest in depicting architectural modernism. We see a lot of spaces here. We see the not the Seagram building, the famous Mies van der Rohe building, but a building very much like it, which is kind of the location for one of the film's key villains. And we see many shots of Bree Daniels moving through these kind of corporate spaces. Bree Daniels is also someone who enjoys nightlife, and she goes to discotheques, which were spaces of leisure and consumption that had recently kind of emerged in the way that we recognize them today, as a place for recorded music to be played continuously and to kind of lose yourself to kind of stay up all night and listen to music. So Bree herself is a very modern woman. And basically the detective, who is very suburban and in some sense naive, is kind of accompanying her through these different spaces. And what I was really interested in is the sense that as Pakula said in an interview, he liked to use architecture to dramatize society. So he's really, the way that he depicts New York is really kind of dramatizing a lot of anxieties that people have that are related to modern architecture and are also related to a distinction that is kind of elided in modern architecture between inside and outside. And a lot of the use of plate glass in modern architecture, for example, is very much about trying to erase the visual distinction between inside and outside. And this corresponds with an emergence in the 1970s of a kind of a fear of crime, a fear of the streets, and a fear of actually going outside, a fear of what might happen to you if you went out, you know, at night. And so I saw Pacula as kind of playing with this dynamic of using modern architecture to kind of play with these fears between inside and outside. And so he's interested in all these kind of weird modern spaces, and they all kind of recur in Clute.
I guess there are two questions. One is what do you make of Bree Daniels' apartment in that context, right? Which is not one of those modern spaces. And then the second question is, what do you think this is telling us, if anything, about the relationship between the city and the suburbs at this moment?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Bree Daniels' apartment in this film, for me, typifies what people think of when they think of a loft apartment, that were, you know, these were spaces that were becoming very popular during this time. It's not technically a loft, but it is open in the ways that most people were, you know, it is kind of, it does have that openness. And Brie herself is, you know, very culturally, she's very interested in the different kind of subcultures in the city. And these, you know, these are the same kind of things that people who are living in lofts are interested in. So Bree Daniels herself is, you know, very chic and very modern. Her costuming, for example, is very much aligned with this, but also her apartment is presented as a space, a fearful space. One of the first things in the film that happens is we see her kind of returning to her apartment, unloading her groceries, and she's sitting in bed, and then she gets a phone call, and it's an anonymous breather call. So there's a suggestion that this space is being watched by someone else, and that she is endangered simply by being in this space from, you know, predation from the outside. In terms of the connection between the city and the suburbs, Bree Daniels is a figure who is, her work is related to servicing suburban commuters. That's her main trade, is working with commuters, businessmen who come from commuter suburbs into the city, presumably from families where the, you know, presumably from their suburban homes with their families, to cheat on their wives with Brie. And so what I saw the film is doing is kind of elaborating this kind of circuit between the suburbs and the city that was in some ways libidinal in nature. The idea that you could leave the suburbs and find something more exciting in the city than a kind of traditional suburban life.
And of course, not to, I was going to say, I think I feel like 1973, we're okay with spoiler alerts. the person who they wind up looking for, right, the missing husband from the suburbs, winds up in the city and is revealed to be a serial killer, right?
The villain,
at least a murderer, maybe.
Yeah, the murderer, the kind of prime murderer in the film, is revealed to be the head of this corporation. Yeah. And who, so you know, who kind of sits atop the city in this expansive office that gives him a view of the Twin Towers, which are in the process of being built at the time.
So if we can, let's move on to you talk about sort of this, I think, really interesting genre of what you call the supercut movies from this period. And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about Serpico, mostly because that may be something that folks are familiar with. You also talk at some length about French Connection in this context. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on in those movies and what do we see going on in the city there?
Sure. So, you know, during the 1970s, I mean, I guess this discourse kind of resonates a little bit with the way that police are being thought of today. But, you know, generally there was an antipathy towards police emanating from the counterculture, and there was a significant effort on the part of law enforcement to change its image and to professionalize its image in many ways. One of the key events that happens in the 1970s on which Serpico is based are the Knapp Commission hearings, which were kind of investigations into police corruption, which, as depicted in Serpico, didn't really, as depicted in Serpico and Sidney Lumet's Prince of the City, in fact, those investigations kind of barely scratched the surface of police corruption, but they generated a lot of interest in what big city police were up to. There's also a kind of a parallel discourse going on, of course, which is the emergence of this idea of this conservative idea of law and order, and the idea that in the cities, crime has run rampant. There's surging crime rates. There's a crisis of civility to do with the ways that all of our suburban children are ignoring the police and protesting the police and protesting the war. And so there's an effort to kind of update the image of the police. And one way that this is done is through this discourse of super cops, which is an image of police as kind of highly professionalized operators who are in some sense also entrepreneurial in nature. And this is, you know, exactly, this kind of fits the figure of Serpico as played by Al Pacino in the film Serpico. To a T. He, you know, Serpico is a kind of an entrepreneurial policeman who stages his own undercover operations, usually without the help of other police officers, and in fact comes under some suspicion from his other police officers for not being on the take. In the film we are shown that the police units that he's associated with are often, you know, taking money, and since he doesn't take money, he's under suspicion. So he has to kind of operate by himself, and this actually kind of fits perfectly with the discourse of the super cop. This kind of crime partners or solo police officers who fight crime by themselves. There's another pretty silly film called The Super Cops, which is based on this pair of police officers in New York who were renowned for, you know, an incredible amount of busts, usually under, you know, the pretenses for making these busts was, you know, pretty low. and they were also kind of mythologized within this super cop discourse. And they were, you know, nicknamed Batman and Robin, and they kind of have this superhero persona. This is kind of the hyperbolization of the super cop mythos. Serpico, I feel, is a little bit more ambivalent, simply because Serpico himself is uneasy about being a police officer. He has a kind of attachment to counterculture. He's called a hippie cop. You know, he's reading the biography of Isadora Duncan. He has a pet mouse that he walks around with. He's very idiosyncratic and quirky, unlike his, you know, conformist fellow police officers. And so he's very uneasy about his identity as a police officer. So in a way, Serpico kind of plays out the ambivalence felt towards police officers during this time.
You're listening to the New Books Network. I am Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we are speaking with Nathan Holmes about his new book, Fear City, Crime, Film, Crisis, and the Urban Imagination. Nathan, finally, I wonder if it is you might talk about a film that, for whatever reason, I am particularly fond of, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. And again, what is the vision of the city that is showing us? And is also sort of, I think, some things to be said there about police as well.
Sure.
What do you think we learn by looking at that movie in the context of what's going on in the period?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, part of the book is looking at all these different like sites where urban fear kind of grows out of or proliferates out of, and one is kind of a darkened city street, and the other is the subway. There's a kind of considerable fear that subways are breaking down. There's a subway fire that happens in the 1970s that attracts considerable amount of attention. The subway is a perfect space in which to kind of enact this kind of sensational narrative of a hostage-taking situation, which is what happens in The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. And it's a hostage-taking situation that kind of animates the whole city. When we watch The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, we see this group of criminals kind of overtake a train stop it in the middle of a tunnel and demand a ransom. And this kind of spurs the whole city to action and actually stops the entire city. And the film itself moves between all these different sites. We move between the subway car itself, the different various offices of the Subway Transit Authority and the subway police, the mayor's office, and they're all kind of communicating with each other about what to do about this situation. And for me, you know, what The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 shows is it really shows how you can use you know, a very a crime narrative that is, you know, in some ways very illogical or perhaps sensational in order to display something about how the city works. You know, if you live in a city, you probably use transit every day and you have no idea how they schedule these trains, how they route them. And one of the pleasures, I think, of watching The Taking of Pelham 123 is that it shows you all this stuff. It shows you the kind of behind the scenes technologies and directors that are involved in orchestrating mass transit in New York. And in a very funny and hilarious way, often it's as much as it's kind of an action film, it's also very lighthearted, and it's very a very, I think, affectionate portrayal of New York and New York City, the people of New York.
You talk in the book about ways in which we might think about Pelham 123 as perhaps an antecedent to The Wire, precisely for that reason, the way in which it sort of gives us this, it's not quite a meta view, but we're sort of moving around to various institutional offices within the city and seeing those systems function in what I think is a really interesting kind of way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was watching The Wire kind of as I started this project, and it was very inspirational for me. And part of the question, you know, part of the question that was prompted for me as I watched The Wire was, okay, you know, The Wire is using this crime narrative to kind of show us all these different sites within the city, all these different, the police, the drug dealers, various city offices, and it's kind of moving up between all of these. But isn't this in some ways what all crime narratives do? Don't all crime films and all kind of crime fictions, aren't they ways to kind of display city life? And in some ways, the project is kind of working backwards to this time period to show that, you know, all of these different films are in some ways antecedents of what The Wire does.
There was a recent remake with Denzel Washington, I think, a couple of years ago. Have you seen that?
I did see it. Yes. I'm a big fan of all types of train and subway movies. so I try to catch all of them. I don't remember it too much. I remember John Travolta was in it. Yeah. I watched Money Train recently. I would even maybe go for that one over the remake of Taking of Pelham 123. Yeah.
So what are you working on now, Nathan?
I'm working on a bunch of little projects that kind of all kind of spin out in some ways, and in some ways are different from the book. I recently published an article on the depiction of office space in the film All the President's Men, which is something that I discuss a little bit, the parking garage in All the President's Men. And in this article, I kind of discuss the way that the film depicts office space and how this resonates with ideas of white collar labor and the idea of the knowledge worker in the 1970s. I'm also working on a piece about prison break films, prison films and prison break films made in the post-war era. There's a number of prison break films that were made in a kind of a semi-documentary manner. They mixed documentary with narrative. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those. And I'm also working on a larger project that has to do with public and semi-public architecture in American film that moves again between a number of different institutional sites. And I'm particularly interested in spaces of work and transportation and leisure. So moving between places like train stations and offices and nightclubs and doing a kind of longer history of those spaces within American film.
You have been listening to Nathan Holmes talking about his new book, Fear City, Crime, Film, Crisis, and the Urban Imagination from State University of New York, SUNY Press. I'm Stephen Pimber, host of the New Books Network Policy Channel. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Stephen. It was great.